Okay, so I'll just start by saying a few things about random issues that struck me in thinking about the conference. I haven't really thought a whole lot about time and consciousness, so it was interesting to be here. I don't know how. It's an incredibly complicated topic. I mean, consciousness alone, complicated topic. Time, complicated topic. Many, many different connections between the two topics, as we've seen the last couple of days. And it's not quite clear how they all fit together. So, I mean, a few ways of thinking about how they fit together. I mean, there's two obvious relationships, two obvious core relations between consciousness and time. One is that consciousness represents time. My conscious experience now, presents things as going on now. My memory represents things as being in the future. I remember things as being in the past. Boy, I anticipate things as being now, being in the future. So consciousness, by its very nature, represents time. So, time is one of the aspects of the contents of consciousness. Consciousness also takes place within time. Presumably, I am having experiences now. I had experiences some seconds ago. I will have some experiences in the future. And so one of the really interesting questions is, what is the relation between those two relations? How does consciousness represent time? How does consciousness take place within time? And what is the relationship between those two relations themselves? In organizing thoughts about this, I thought it's useful to distinguish between actually three different sort of axes around which all this stuff revolves. This is my, after all the PowerPoint, I thought I wasn't even going to try. Here is my high-tech visual aid. So we have a triangle, a golden triangle of three key points. And the questions, many of the questions I think we can raise as being about the relationship between these three things. First of all, the temporal contents of consciousness, the representational contents of consciousness insofar as they pertain to time, representing certain things as going on now, as having just happened, as being about to happen, and so on. There you think of time as a representational content of consciousness, just like color and shape and so on, the way things temporally seem to be. Secondly, the temporal properties of consciousness. Conscious experiences have properties such as, occurring one after the other in succession. Having experiences can have a certain duration. Some happen in the past relative to others, and so on. So we can talk about the temporal properties of consciousness, and then we can talk about the temporal properties of things in the world. Just ordinary things, particles and people, and so on. And there's interesting relationships, I think, among all three of these vertices. What's the relationship between this one and this one? Well, these things, the temporal contents of consciousness, represent these things, temporal properties of things in the world, or so it seems. I experience my arm is moving downwards. That represents certain temporal properties of my arm, that it being down here after it's up here. So this represents this. What's the relationship between this and this, temporal properties and temporal properties of consciousness and temporal properties of things in the world? Well, presumably it's, inclusion, right? Because consciousness is a thing in the world, so temporal properties of consciousness are among the things in the world. But the temporal properties of consciousness, maybe conscious experiences are a particularly distinguished class of things in the world. Still, if there's a general theory of the temporal properties of things in the world, it better apply to temporal properties of consciousness too. And then I think the hardest and most vexed question, in some ways, is the relationship between this thing, the way that time is represented in consciousness, and the time at which conscious experiences occur. So I'll say a little bit more about that axis in what follows. So thinking about the talks here, I think a number of the talks, I think really the talks focus on this, on the relationship between this and this, and on the relationship between this and this. So this temporal contents of consciousness is really a central vertex around which many of the talks at the conference revolved. So at different levels, I think. We had explorations of the temporal contents of consciousness at the level of perception, as in, for example, Barry's and Philippe's talk, and at the broader level of, say, memory, as came up in Janan's and Jordi's talks, and also in anticipation, as came up in Janan's talk as well. So you can think of what was going on in, for example, Jordi's and Janan's talks as giving you know, very far ingrained, sophisticated treatment of the way that time is represented in memory, and in part in anticipation. And part of what was going on in Philippe's and Barry's talk, especially in Philippe's talk, was the way in which time is represented in the short term in perceptual experience, the representation of succession. Simon, I should also mention Simon's talk here. It doesn't fit quite so well into this picture. It's pretty close to this, but I think of time as Simon's talk is focusing on our conceptions of time, not necessarily in memory or in perception, but in, you know, in belief, in art, in thought. So the way in which we think, the way in which the concept of time works there. So you can think about that as in some broad sense concerning the temporal contents of consciousness. Then there are questions about the relationship between temporal contents of consciousness and the temporal properties of things in the world. I think, you know, Craig's talk focused very much on that question, you know, the way in which experience seems to represent things as being, say, present, objectively present, and what guidance this might or might not give us when it comes to the question of whether things in the world really do have these properties of being objectively present. Steve's talk focused, I think, especially on, you know, interesting temporal properties of that things in the world might have, you know, existing in one-dimensional time or two-dimensional time, and so on. And the upshot of that, the implications of that for thinking about consciousness. And then on this axis here, I think Barry's talk and Philippe's talk were really about, you know, what is the relationship between the temporal contents of consciousness, experiencing things in succession, and the temporal properties of those conscious states. So Philippe made the case that when he made a point about the contents, we don't actually experience succession, and he drew certain morals about the relationship between that to the temporal properties of consciousness. The apparent experience of succession actually comes from the succession of experiences, a temporal property of consciousness. Or Barry drew a different connection here, that the experience of succession actually involves certain extended states of consciousness. That is, he appealed to different temporal properties of consciousness to explain these things here. So I think, you know, so this is really, as I see it, the central vertex. Understanding the temporal contents of consciousness, its relationship to temporal properties of things in the world, and its relation to the temporal properties of consciousness. And really, the temporal contents of consciousness, I think you can study in the same way that we study the contents of consciousness in general: color, shape, visual consciousness, auditory consciousness, a combination of empirical methods, experimental methods studying the brain, philosophical analysis, and importantly, phenomenology. So particularly here in this conference, we focus on the phenomenology of the contents of consciousness and drew some connections to the other things. Getting down to a slightly more fine-grained level, I think you can address the questions both about the contents, the relation to the properties of things in the world, the relationship to the temporal properties of consciousness, and at a couple of different levels. Roughly speaking, just as people often divide properties of time into the A aspects of, you know, the A aspects of time and the B aspects of time, the nowness, presentness, the futureness, the pastness, and the relational stuff like succession and duration. I think we can raise the questions here at this level. So some of the questions that were coming up, focusing first on the A-ish properties of time, and especially, you know, think about the heavy-duty A properties of time that the A theorist believes in, the things like objective presentness and flow and so on. I think you can ask questions about, you know, those sort of aspects of time at each of these levels. I mean, the traditional question in metaphysics is cast at this level. Do things in the world really have A properties? Do they have objective presentness? Do they flow? Is there passage? And so on. Whether or not you believe that's the case in general, you can also ask the further question, do we represent things? Do our conscious states represent things as flowing, as passing, as being objectively present? And you can also ask the third question, do our conscious states themselves, are they objectively present? Is there passage among conscious states? And these questions are all somewhat separate questions. I'm inclined to think that of the three, the most plausible candidate for being a one where the A properties really make it into the picture is in the first one, the temporal contents of consciousness. I think you can actually make a pretty reasonably strong case that, you know, in some sense, the representational content of consciousness really does represent things as flowing, as being objectively present, and so on. In a way, it's analogous to what many people think goes on in the case of color. Many people take it that in color experience, we represent things in the world as having these special, sensuous color properties, you know, primitive redness and primitive blueness that objects in the world may not have, as revealed, say, by physics. Likewise, you might think, so I mean, I once wrote a paper where really talking about the color case, where the idea was, well, back in the Garden of Eden, that was the world where things were exactly as they seem to us in perceptual experience, exactly as they're represented in perceptual experience. Things really had properties such as perfect redness, perfect blueness. They had, you know, the apple was primitively red, and you were just directly acquainted with that redness, and you thereby experienced it. Well, I think you could likewise talk about the Eden for time, right? The Eden for time is where the world where things are exactly as they seem to us temporally in experience is plausibly an A universe, where there's, you know, some kind of passage, some kind of presentness, and so on. But that's just to make a claim about the temporal contents of consciousness. It's not to say the world really is that way, and one can quite naturally, you can see Craig's talk is tending in that direction at least, ruling out the A properties from things in the world, seeing them as present in the contents of consciousness. Then the residual question is, does consciousness itself flow? Does consciousness itself pass? This involves this crucial kind of inference from the temporal contents of consciousness representing things as, say, flowing, as passing, as being objectively present, to conscious states themselves having that property. And some people at least have found that kind of inference, the inference from here to here, at least having something going for it, over and above, that the inference from this to this doesn't obviously have going for it. But those are two questions you can separate. And then we can ask the same set of questions about the B properties, duration and succession, which really, I think, was the focus of Philippe's and Barry's paper, that the temporal contents of consciousness, at least to appear, to involve the attribution of such B properties of, you know, one thing succeeding, another thing, events as lasting a certain amount of time. And then likewise, we can ask the same two questions about those B properties. Do things in the world, well, first of all, you could ask the question, do things in the world really have duration and succession and so on? And in this case, I think it's fairly uncontroversial to say that they do. So the core question on which Barry and Philippe's talk focused was, given that duration and succession and so on at least appear to be represented in consciousness, what implications do these have for the temporal properties of consciousness? And in particular, how does the representation of duration and succession and so on in perceptual consciousness, how might that be grounded in certain temporal properties, that is, duration and duration of conscious experiences, succession among conscious experiences, and what are the relationship between those two things? And both Philippe and Barry ended up giving certain crucial role for the temporal properties of consciousness in explaining certain things about the temporal contents or the apparent temporal contents of consciousness. So this is, I think, one of the really the big residual issues, at least for me, in thinking about this stuff, is what kind of inferences can you make from the fact that things like duration and succession and so on are represented in a certain way in consciousness to conclusions about duration and succession as properties of consciousness. I mean, this, in a way, it parallels a familiar... I mean, the issue comes up, I think, both for the question of A properties versus B properties, you know, flow here, flow being represented versus, you know, passage being represented, to passage at the level of the states, and for the B properties, duration and succession at the level of what's represented to duration and succession at the level of states. And in a way, it's a familiar issue in philosophy that's already comes up when thinking about the case of color and shape and so on. You know, we represent redness out there in the world. Does that entail or imply or suggest that our experiences are in some way red? You know, traditionally, the sense datum theorists have wanted to say yes to this question. There's, you know, this actually provides reasons for believing there's something red or something with some property at least closely analogous to red at the level of our experience, while the representationalists have wanted to deny that. They say that red is merely represented in our experience. The experiences themselves needn't be red. Same for shape. You can represent squareness in the world without the experience itself being square. So tempting in some ways to say that the case of time is going to be just very similar to the case of color and shape. Most people, by and large, the orthodoxy these days is not to make inferences from redness represented to redness in experience, squareness represented to squareness in experience. So very tempted to say, okay, we ought to treat the case of time similarly and don't make any inferences from time being represented to temporal properties of experience. Still, At the same time, there's some intuition, I think, that time is special here. I think this is one of the interesting things about the connection between time and consciousness. Those inferences that seem to be sort of maybe arguably manifestly bad in the case of color and shape, at least still have some intuitive pull on us in the case of time, that, you know, there's some pretty strong intuitive pull to the idea that when we have a experience of duration, that somehow necessarily ties or is very strongly grounded in a duration of the experience. Experience of succession, very strongly grounded in succession among experiences, and so on. So, again, for me, a really interesting question is, what might be special here? Do we have what grounds can we make for getting at conclusions about the temporal properties of consciousness? Obviously, there are, you know, empirical grounds we might get to through experimental methods and studies of the brain, but, you know, phenomenologically and introspectively, do we even have access to the temporal properties of consciousness, such as duration and succession of experience, or do we merely have access to the temporal contents of consciousness, the way that duration and succession are represented, and then somehow make inferences from there to the temporal properties of consciousness? Just to, I think it's a general question that leaves resolving. Just to finish, just one little thought on the that might help to at least get at and maybe give some little support to the idea that time is special here. I think in the case of color, right, or in the case of squareness, there's an intuition that I think many people at least have the view that one can mix and match arbitrarily the properties of the representational state and the properties of what's represented. So in principle, you know, a square state of my brain could represent circularity in the environment. A green state of my brain could represent redness in the environment. So maybe for a second, assume a materialistic picture where states of experience are states of the brain. No conceptual problem of that. So question, can you do that for the temporal properties of consciousness versus the temporal contents of consciousness? Can those be mixed and matched arbitrarily in the same way? That is, could representational states with arbitrary temporal properties represent goings-on with arbitrary temporal content? So, you know, so take some temporal experience I might have of representing a certain succession of events with certain durations and so on, and now say, could we take those representational states and arbitrarily change their temporal properties and keep the same temporal contents? For example, could you run my brain backwards? Or, you know, could you have a... Could you take my temporal experience over the course of 10 minutes and, you know, play the chunk of the last 10 seconds and the previous 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 10 seconds in that order? That's massively varying the temporal properties of consciousness, but nonetheless keeping the temporal contents of consciousness the same. Two questions. One is, you know, if you did that, if you took that kind of arbitrary mixing and matching of the temporal properties of consciousness, would it be introspectively indistinguishable from the state of the original case? And would it be phenomenologically distinguishable or indistinguishable from that of the original case? I really don't know the answer to this, but at least, I mean, there's some prima facie intuition here that, damn it, it just couldn't be phenomenologically the same, that, you know, utterly changing the order of experiences, the temporal properties of experience would have to have some effect on the phenomenology of experience. Now, maybe that intuition is wrong. I don't know that it's right. Insofar, I think that intuition certainly has some tug on us in the case of time in a way in which it doesn't in the case of color and shape. I don't know whether it's an intuition that should be credited or not, but I think it's one that's worth paying attention to, because insofar as there is that kind of necessary connection there, and you can't mix and match arbitrarily, that tends to suggest that maybe there's something going on in the case of time that makes the connection between these two things closer than there is in the case of, say, color and shape. So the standard representational lessons don't quite so obviously apply. If, on the other hand, that intuition is mistaken and bankrupt, then we ought to treat the case of time as analogous to the case of color and shape, and be much more dubious about making this inference. In which case, you know, it's going to be much less clear that we can draw conclusions about the temporal properties of consciousness and the temporal properties of things in the world from these phenomenological claims about the temporal contents of consciousness. Okay, so I'll stop there and then move on to Uriah.
So I figured what I'll do is two things. First, kind of go through how I processed the main themes that came up in the conference, and then run some propaganda for my own kind of take on consciousness and why I think that maybe a lot of the these are the thoughts that I had while listening to the talks, that they might lend lend support to the kind of view that I have of consciousness. So there is a distinction, maybe the first distinction that people make when they discuss consciousness, is between two separate properties that go under the name consciousness. One is a property that specific mental states have. You have a conscious thought about a banana. And a gorilla can have a conscious thought about a banana. And these are different mental states, and each is conscious. There are also unconscious beliefs that you have about bananas. Now, there is also a property that's not a property of particular mental states, but a property of creatures. So you can say gorillas are conscious, but snails aren't. Or I think maybe snails are. I think, did we establish that cats aren't conscious? Was that Steve established that at some point? So these are two different properties, the property of states and the property of creatures. And we can just distinguish them by calling them state consciousness and creature consciousness. And I think correspondingly, there is a distinction that we may make between state phenomenology and creature phenomenology. So there is something it's like for me to have an experience of red. But there is also something it's like for me to be me. And there's one view is that what it's like for me to be me is just what it's like for me to go through all the experiences that I've ever gone through, etc. But someone else might say maybe I know what it's like for Dave to see red, but I don't know what it's like to be Dave. Someone else might come back and say, actually, that's only the case because there are things about Dave's mental life that you've never experienced. There are experiences. I don't know what it's like to think this fast. This is something that I can't really imagine and experience. But if I could, then I would be able to know what it's like to be Dave. But maybe not. Anyway, why do I go through this? Because I think the talks divided into two. Those that discuss the state phenomenology involved in temporal consciousness and those that discuss the creature phenomenology of temporal consciousness. So I'm thinking of Barry, Philippe, Craig, and Jordi's talks as concerned with state phenomenology of temporal consciousness, and Janan, Simon, and Steve's as concerning the creature phenomenology. Now, interestingly, there has been a bit of a discrepancy about in the spirit of the talks that in the two camps. So there is a distinction that sometimes people make about phenomenology, views of phenomenology. Some people think that phenomenology is very thin. When I look at, let's say, my mother's face, I see just certain colors, shapes, things like that. That's all I see. That's all that's present in phenomenology. The phenomenology is a phenomenology of a certain color, a certain shape, etc. Other people think that phenomenology is a bit more inflated than that. It's represented in the experience that it's a face. It's not just a shape and a color. It's a face. Maybe not just a face, but my mother's face. You know, someone that you love's face, all this stuff. And so the inflationist thinks that there's a lot going on in consciousness, that phenomenology is rich, whereas the deflationist thinks that it's very thin. I'm personally always preferred in kind of a bit of an inflationist line. Of course, it comes in degrees. And I've always preferred an inflationist line. For instance, if you look at the duck rabbit, I think there is an experiential event that takes place when you switch from seeing it as a duck to seeing it as a rabbit, even though everything at the shapes and color level is the same. And a bit more of a mesmerizing example is this painting by Dalí, where I think it's you don't just see colors and shapes, you see the bust of Voltaire, maybe not as the bust of Voltaire, but definitely as some kind of bust, or face at least. Maybe you even see the nuns there that make up, whose face make up his eyes. You might have all kinds of experiential events taking place looking at this that go beyond just colors and shapes. Now, what's interesting, I think, is that when people talked about the state phenomenology, there was quite a bit of deflationism going on. A lot of claims were that there's less in the temporal phenomenology than you might think on first glance. So Berry argued that when you look at the specious present, that's the main state phenomenological feature of the temporal consciousness, there isn't really a retentive kind of content. There is just, we can account for the specious present without postulating a sort of phenomenologically rich, retentive content, but instead just appeal to the properties of the vehicles, I think, the extendedness of consciousness. So there is no retention. Then Philippe came on and said, actually, there's no specious present at all. There's a phenomenology of succession. Sorry, there's a succession of experiences, but there isn't an experience of succession. There is, obviously, we have a sense of a succession, but it's not given in the phenomenology. The phenomenology is just one of succession of experiences. There's no experience of succession, so there is no specious present. Then Craig rolled in and said, actually, there's no present. Or at least it was pretty hesitant, I think, Craig said. When I look inside, I can't really find a phenomenology of presentness. And then finally, Jordi came in today and said, at least about memory, it's not representing time at all. It's about causation, what caused the experience. It seemed that there is a feeling of pastness. It seems that there is the experience represents some kind of temporal properties. But actually, there's nothing to do with time that goes on in memory. So there's more and more deflationism. I really like the retention view. So I have to say that, yes, time is represented, specifically the present, which is specious, and that's because it's retentive. Consciousness is retentive. So I have to say all this. And I think one of the, if there is something to lay out on the agenda for people working on time in consciousness is to sort of figure out some kind of way where we can make progress on this. What kind of considerations are supposed to be adduced that would push us toward an inflationist or deflationist view of phenomenology? By contrast, what we saw in the creature phenomenology is runaway inflationism. The most striking claim, I thought, was Genin's claim that there is a non-supervenient temporal phenomenology, right? That you can have two people who all their experiences were exactly the same throughout their life, but someone has good memory and the other one is forgetful, and what it's like to be them is completely different because the first personal perspective would be different. Genin described it as two fields, but where your location is within the field will change your experience of the whole field. So that's how I sort of processed and digested all the talks and the main themes that they brought up. Now to my own little bit. Views of consciousness, you look at the tree and you have an experience of the tree. One view is that what makes your thought about the tree a conscious thought, a conscious experience, is that it represents the tree and represents it in the right way. I think Alex is one of the people who defended this view most thoroughly. Another view that some people hold is that this is not enough. You can represent the tree consciously or unconsciously. Something extra is needed, and specifically what is needed is a second thought. So when you are conscious of the tree, you have a conscious experience of the tree, you are having two thoughts, or at least two mental states, one which represents the tree and one which represents the first order representation. My own view is something in between, which I call self-representationalism, or the self-representational view of consciousness, according to which what makes the mental state conscious is that it's represented by itself.
That's what makes it conscious. And like I said, there were a lot of talks that made me sort of excited about the possibility that this might have, this view might have some interesting contact with issues that come up in temporal phenomenology. In particular, here is you again. Jordi claimed that memory is token reflexive. So token reflexivity, just for those who haven't read Searle in the past week, suppose I'm looking at this chair and I have an experience of this of a chair just like this, but as it happened, it's not that I'm seeing this chair, I'm tripping on acid and I'm presented with a chair just like this. And the chair is really here. It's really here. Or maybe I'm presented with a pink elephant in the middle of the room, and while I'm hallucinating, while I'm tripping, there's a pink elephant that's coming in and sort of standing right where my hallucination is, my hallucinated elephant is. We want to say that this is an hallucination, that I'm not getting things right, that I'm not perceiving correctly the elephant. We want to say that I'm misperceiving, that I'm hallucinating. The only way to do it, Searle claims, is that I don't just represent an elephant or a chair. I'm representing the elephant as the cause of this very experience of the elephant. That's what I experience. I experience an elephant that's causing this very elephant experience. I'm experiencing this chair as the cause of this very chair experience. And in that respect, in that sense, the experience is about itself. It's token reflexive, as he puts it. It's about itself. And Jordi claimed that memories must be, so your consciousness of the past, let's say, memory experiences, consciousness of the past, is token reflexive, right? If you're going to get the right amount of information, as Jordi put it, you have to experience, to have a memory of the event remembered as the cause of this very memory experience. Now, Jenan mentioned something very interesting in passing. It wasn't quite central. But that anticipations, when you look at the anticipations, I think it was a quote from Velleman, that we anticipate, consciously anticipate something in the future. We don't just want this thing to happen, to happen. We anticipate, we want it to happen as a payoff of the fact that we anticipated, as a payoff of the anticipating. Not exactly sure that I put it in the right way. But there is this token reflexive, the anticipation is of something that will happen as the payoff of this very anticipation. And then Philippe said something very interesting, somewhat in passing, but not only. This is my best representation of consciousness of the present. I didn't know where I should go with this. Yeah, that's what I ended up with. Yeah, Philippe said, look, we have a phenomenology of the present moment. The experience is experience of something as occurring now. Or, sorry, I shouldn't have said that. As occurring presently. Yeah, of course, that was rejected later by Craig and Jordi. But said, if you're an atheist, you might think that what that comes to is that the experience represents whatever it represents as occurring now. But if you're a B theorist, you can't do that. So you have to say something like, whatever the experience represents, whatever it represents, as being simultaneous with this very experience. That's the only kind of property that the B theorist can appeal to. So if that's true, then even consciousness of the present is token reflexive. It's consciousness of something as simultaneous with this very experience that I'm having. And maybe this threefold token reflexivity is somehow accounts for the way we go through time and are sort of aware of our location in time, aware of where we stand, not only where the past is, where the future is, where the present is, but where we are in relation to all these things. It sort of keeps a tag. We keep our tag on ourselves through these three forms of token reflexivity. And my claim is that, of course, that wouldn't be possible if consciousness didn't represent itself, if conscious experiences were not self-representing. Conscious experiences it's only because conscious experiences are self-representing that a picture like this can be correct. And so that's pretty exciting, and that's the paper I'm going to write next week, which is kind of cool because a friend asked me a few months ago, I saw you're involved in a time and consciousness conference. So you started working on time and consciousness? And I said, no, I can't work on time and consciousness because I don't know where to start even. I don't know how to start thinking about time and consciousness. It's such a mind-stretching, so to speak, a topic, time and consciousness, temporal phenomenology. But I think this conference helped me to sort of know where to start thinking about it. So that was great. We clap now.
All right, I will make a few brief jokes to take us through to the visit to the pub. Well, thanks again to Hugh and Dave and Uriah and the rest for organizing such a terrific conference. I really learnt a lot. Okay, so here are some disconnected comments. This little gizmo takes a long while to work. But no. This is my own personal gizmo. Believe me, this should work. Come on. Okay. How about that? All right, things should be fine from here on in. Okay, so Simon quoted us some Locke. Here's a passage from that same bit of the essay where Locke is talking about where we get our ideas of our idea of duration from. And he says, to understand time and eternity aright, we ought with attention to consider what idea it is we have of duration, how we came by it. It is evident to anyone who will but observe what passes in his own mind that there is a train of ideas which constantly succeed one another in his understanding as long as he is awake. Reflection on these appearances of several ideas, one after the other in our minds, is that which furnishes us with the idea of succession, and the distance between any parts of that succession or between the appearance of any two ideas in our minds is that we call duration. So the idea is that, and I think this was a sort of picture shared by Philippe and Barry, the idea is that in addition to being aware of certain events and processes taking place in the external world, I can shift my attention to the internal world, to my own experiences, and have a gander at their temporal properties. The first question I want to raise is whether that's actually right, whether there's such a thing as Locke's train of ideas. In addition, something of which we can become introspectively aware, a process or succession of ideas in time, much as we can become extrospectively aware of a process or succession of things in our environment. So we're certainly aware of the timing of external events and processes. And the question is, are you also independently aware of the timing of some internal event or process, your experience of the external event? And that seems to me entirely unobvious and needs arguing for. Here's some familiar epistemology of how we know temporal properties of our mental states. which I think has to be resisted as a complete account by Barry and Philippe. So I am aware, of course, say that I heard the clock chime for about a minute. So I know that I started to hear the clock chime a certain time, and then I stopped hearing it after about a minute. So that's one way in which one can become aware of temporal properties of one's own mental states. But plausibly, that's not to have any independent access to the timing of some mental event, an experience, or a chunk of my alleged stream of consciousness. How do I know that I heard the clock chime for about a minute? Well, that's because I attend to the clock in my environment, and I notice that it did chime for a minute. And from that piece of information about the timing of an event in the external world, I have a piece of information about the duration of a state in, if you like, the internal world. But that's not to invoke any kind of quasi-perceptual access to some stream of events in consciousness. So it's not clear to me at all that the that the account that Barry and Philippe were, I think, presupposing of our access to temporal properties of consciousness is right. Okay, here's another connected issue, and I think it's also related to something Dave mentioned about how it's very tempting to think that the brain can only represent time with time, not with anything else. So here's a man looking at a red tomato, and some people, of course, Barry, I believe, are sense datum theorists. So when the guy looks at a red tomato, maybe you'd want to say, if you're a sense datum theorist, the guy sees the red tomato only indirectly. He sees it by way of seeing or by being aware of something mental, or at any rate, not something clearly physical, a sense datum corresponding to that tomato. Okay. Now, even though traditionally sense data were taken to be, as it might be, coloured, more recently people have taken them not to be coloured, but rather to have other properties instead, which are, although not colours, nonetheless intimately related to colours. And Philippe actually mentioned this in passing. This red prime terminology is due to Peacock. Sometimes people use phenomenally red for the same idea. So here the thought is, look, here's the red tomato. Here's the sense datum corresponding to the tomato. The tomato is red, but the sense datum, which of course bears that distinctive qualitative property that's supposed to be so problematic, that's not red. That's actually red prime, or it's phenomenally red. Okay, now why would one distinguish between red prime and red? Why would you think that they're different? Well, Philippe gave the answer. It's that physics has... I mean, if you're a sense datum theorist, of course, all this is sort of modulo the sense datum theory. Physics has shown us, supposedly, that the tomato isn't... Physics has shown us that the tomato isn't red prime. Physics has shown us that the tomato... that the tomato doesn't have this distinctive qualitative property possessed by the sense datum. That's what physics has shown us. Okay, so since the tomato is red, of course, that's just a piece of common sense, redness and red primeness must be distinct. So that's a way of arguing that the qualitative properties of sense data are different from the corresponding properties of external objects. And you might think, if you were sort of tempted by this idea, that you should say exactly the same thing for time. So now thinking of Craig's talk. Similarly, physics has no present, right? And presentness, let's suppose, is some property of an event consisting of the occurrence of a certain sense datum. So the so-called temporal properties of sense data, or if you like, experiences, stuff in the inner world, they shouldn't be identified with the temporal properties of events in the external world. You should distinguish between, as it might be, time prime and time, or you should distinguish between phenomenal time and clock time, just as sense datum theorists distinguish between red prime, or phenomenal redness, and plain old redness. But, interestingly enough, people don't, even those who are favorably inclined towards the sense datum theory, don't seem to want to do that. They don't think that, as it were, phenomenal time is different from external or clock time. So I'd be interested to hear what Barry has to say on this issue. Some interesting question arises, well, just why is that so? Because there would seem to be some parallel consideration in favor of distinguishing phenomenal time from physical time, just as there's supposedly a consideration in favor of distinguishing phenomenal redness from genuine redness. Okay. Turning now to the content of experience and the block view of time versus the A-series or flowing view of time. So there are offhand three views about the temporal content of experience. Dave also mentioned this as well in the light case. One is that the content of experience is entirely tenseless. It's the light is flashing at T at a first pass. Obviously, that would be, if that was the content of the experience, as far as time is concerned, then it would be completely compatible with the B theory or the block view. Alternatively, one might think that the content is somehow tensed. The light is flashing now. And here I don't mean necessarily to suggest that the content, the proposition, is different from the proposition expressed by this sentence. You might, just as people often say, well, even though the light is flashing now, the light seems to have stopped flashing. That's strange. Even though the light is flashing now expresses the same proposition as the light is flashing at T, even if now is T, nonetheless, you've got to distinguish the belief state that would typically be referred to if you said someone believes the light is flashing now. Similarly, someone might say in the visual case, there's a special kind of tense visual state you're in when you seem to see, as we would say, that the light is flashing now. In any event, on this view, just as on this view, even though there's something tensed about the content or something tensed about the state, that fact is compatible with the entirely compatible with the B theory, even under the assumption that the experience is veridical. So these are two views about the content of the temporal content of experience that are compatible with the B theory. Here's a view that isn't compatible with the B theory, assuming that visual experiences are veridical with respect to their temporal component, namely that light is flashing now, where this is supposed to refer to some objective present of the sort that Craig denies. So these are three views, and so there's some issue which I don't think was fully resolved about which one is correct. I mean, I should say, of course, whenever a philosopher writes an ordinary word in block capitals, that's a sort of sure, like, you know, the world or something in block capitals, it's a sure sign that he doesn't know what he's talking about. And so I certainly don't know what the difference between this view and this view actually amounts to. But anyway. So Dave also mentioned this view.
I can't completely but screw it.
What?
It's all block capitals.
What's all block capitals?
On my slide. Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah, right, yeah. Okay, so then another issue, and I'm getting towards the end. Another issue that that came up in a number of talks, and which I mean, in my own mind, all this is a very autobiographical. These are just sort of questions that greatly puzzled me over the course of the conference. Is what the source of the temptation for the A series or tenth view of time is. Now, there is a similar temptation in the case of I, which is actually brought out very nicely in Nagel's book, The View from Nowhere, which Simon mentioned. So the thought is, well, you know, if you were God looking down on the universe impersonally described, there would still be some, you know, intuitively some further fact about the universe left out by the view sub specie eternitatis, namely, which of these individuals is me? But as Tim pointed out, there isn't a similar temptation for here. And I'm sure, I don't really know this A series, B series literature, I'm sure various diagnoses have been proposed, but offhand, I don't know of any. Or I don't know of any that seem to me remotely plausible, so I'd be interested to hear of any suggestions. It's just offhand completely mysterious why, this is definitely the case, we have a strong temptation towards the A theory. Even B theorists, apart from Craig, of course, can at least sympathize with those of us who feel the tug of the A theory. But why? Forget whether it's true or not, why on earth are we moved in that way, given that we're definitely not in the case of here. No one thinks that there's some objective here, some privileged spatial location in the universe. Okay, and then finally, memory. There's so many excellent things being said about memory by Jordi and Janan and others. It was hard to find one thing to put on a slide, but anyway, here's one thing that occurred to me. It's just really a rhetorical question. So perception delivers information processed by one's, processed by one's senses about the present state of one's environment. And episodic memory, well, at any rate, arguably, delivers information processed by one's senses about the past state of one's environment. It's the same, basically the same information, although now indexed to the past rather than the present. At any rate, if assuming that Jordi's wrong about this, there's no adulteration of the memory. Sorry, there's no adulteration of the information by memory when things are working correctly. There's no sort of additional stuff thrown in. It's basically the same information. No doubt substantially degraded that you got through perception in the first place. Well, if so, then it seems that episodic memory should be regarded, or it wouldn't be at all misleading to regard it, as a kind of faculty of perceiving the past. But nonetheless, there seems to be some strong intuitive resistance to the idea that we perceive the past as the past. But there seems to be some very simple, maybe not entirely uncontroversial, but for some fairly simple, reasonably compelling set of considerations, which would lead to the conclusion that you should regard memory, episodic memory, as the faculty of perceiving the past. Okay, so a summary of the questions that puzzled me. Is there really something like Locke's train of ideas of which we're introspectively aware in the first place? Well, actually, this one doesn't puzzle me, because the answer to that is no. Are clock time and phenomenal time the same in the way that someone might say, okay, you know, red prime and redness, they're actually the same. The tomato is red and the corresponding sense datum literally has the very same property. And is the content of experience, modulo veridicality, I should have said, incompatible at all with the B theory? What's the source of the attraction of the A theory in the first place? And finally, can we perceive via memory events as past? And so since Syd Barrett recently died, I thought it would be appropriate to end with some lyrics from Pink Floyd's Time. Hanging on in quiet desperation is the English way, not the Australian way, of course. The time is gone, the song is over. Thought I'd have something more to say, but apparently not. I hope that will do.
Okay, we don't actually have a round table, but we thought we could approximate it a little bit by, Alex and Uriah and I can sit here. Speakers could come down and occupy these, and other people maybe can sort of come a little bit to tend forward in the auditorium, and then we can have something approximating a round table for the last half hour or so. But if you were a speaker, if you gave a talk, then come up and hang out in one of these chairs.
Do you want to sit down over there?
Okay, so I thought basically anyone can, we can just have sort of questions, people can kick around anything that might have struck them, either in response to any of these presentations or, boy, can we get some lights on these guys? Good. or in response to the conference as a whole. I thought maybe you guys could get first crack at it if you wanted to. There was a question or two. I seem to recall there was a question for Barry in there and other stuff. Don't feel any obligation. Janelle. If anybody else. Yeah, Philippe.
Just in response to Alex's accusations. Right, so Barry and I...
Don't you mean decisive arguments?
Sorry?
Don't you mean incisive arguments? All right.
Barry and I seem to be committed, both of us, despite the differences, or the view I was sketching and Barry's view, to the idea that there can be succession of experiential events.
Right.
But you also said that there's a claim that we can have introspective access to these events and introspective access to the fact that they succeed one another.
Right. Well, you're committed to that, right? Because
I'm not sure that's...
There's
an issue as to whether I'm making the claim that there's a succession. How do I know that?
But
I haven't said anything about the epistemology. You know, I've suggested that, in fact, it's very messy and we're quite fallible about these things. But it's not clear that neither Barry nor I were really committed to... You know, strong claims about this introspective access to these events, only to the existence of this, not necessarily to some kind of fairly reliable privilege, you know, epistemic access to that.
No, I didn't. Yeah, right. I didn't mean to say anything about privileged access, but in your own case, let me just set Barry aside for a moment. But in your own case, you were sort of struck by some coincidence between the succession of experiences representing various events and then the succession of the corresponding events. And that would seem to presuppose that you have some independent access to the temporal properties of the experiences. I mean, if one is just reading off... we were talking about this a bit last night... My own view is that there really aren't any such things as experiences or an area. It's much better to put things that way. But just assuming that there are, the only access you have to the temporal properties of these things is via your access to the temporal properties of events in your environment, then, as it were, there's no kind of coincidence to be explained or anything like that. You were sort of presupposing, I think, that you have one route to the temporal properties of events in your
content.
What?
You had access to some change in experience, that's true.
Yeah.
But whether that was access to the fact that there's a discussion. Yeah. I might not be doing that, but you know, it's not obvious
what to claim.
The sort of introspective access you were describing? I don't know.
You don't want to say that sessions present the experience, it's just a matter of beliefs we have about experiences.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but you thought that
it's not as if, you know, there's a succession of experiences that introspect them. Okay, right. There's you know, experience of T1, experience of T2. Oh, and then I make an inferential mistake. Oh, there must have been an experience of succession. It's not supposed to be like that. No claim to the effect that that's how things work.
Suppose I see a flash and then I hear a bang.
Right.
So the flash occurs before the bang.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I thought, maybe I'm misremembering, I thought you then said, okay, well, here is some striking fact that my experience of the flash occurs before.
Well, there seems to be a change in content. At a certain time, there's a representation of you know, a flash, and then later there seems to be a representation of a bang.
So, Barry, do you want to come in on this with respect to either your own view or?
I'm working on the phenomenological level. Phenomenologically, it seems to me there is such a thing as a chain of ideas. Just do it in sort of abstracting from different views of perception. If I think to myself, 1, 2, 3, internally, in this a little bit.
Right.
Aware of myself, sort of in my acoustic imagination going.
Right.
And that seems to be directly aware of the 1, 2, 3. In that sense, it seems to me that there's a strong phenomenological foundation of saying that there is a thing as a chain of ideas.
Yeah, but
I
see. Perception. I mean, maybe this is where we just. Sorry, Evan, let me just.
Just want to make sure Barry was finished.
Sorry. Yeah.
Finger
on
that?
So, I was wondering on Alex's view. If you're hallucinating something, so there is no, what was the example you used? Was it the clock, the chime of the clock that took place for a minute or something?
Right, yeah.
Suppose you're hallucinating the clock.
Right.
Would you be able to tell how long you hallucinated it?
Because
your view, it looks like you have to say, you know, I form beliefs about how long my experience took on the basis of the duration of the thing that I'm experiencing, in this case, the clock. Suppose there's no clock.
Right. I mean, well, still, but you're still attending to, as it were, the clock that seems to be there but isn't. It's not as if you're phenomenologically you're sort of shifting in the hallucination case. Even if you know you're hallucinating, suppose I'm hallucinating a pink rat, and you know, Craig says, "Well, tell me how long this pink rat hallucination lasts." It's not as if, even if I know I'm hallucinating, there's some shift of attention from the ostensible rat to my internal world or something like that. I still keep my attention focused on, as it were, the non-existent rat. And I note, well, okay, how long is that rat around for? And then as soon as it vanishes, I tell Craig, okay, I've stopped hallucinating the rat.
Can you hallucinate a clock which is running, say, twice as fast as normal? And if so, how do you know that it's running twice as fast as normal?
Yes, but why does this?
Well, you're not using the clock to measure how fast it's going in that case. So I was wondering what you are using.
Oh right, but yeah, but we can. Of course, we can. We have a sense of duration that we can use, even though we're not perceiving any kind of external chronometer. So I can sort of just stare at that cup. And then think, okay, I've been staring at it for roughly a minute or something.
Okay, because I think you were saying in the case of the original clock,
the
way you knew it had been chiming for a minute was by, using the information that its face provided.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. Yeah, that was a mistake. I didn't mean to say that. That was a bad example. I just meant, you know, you're hearing a sound. You can detect that the sound lasts for a minute. Okay, you can also detect something mental, namely that you've been hearing it for a minute. But the way you do that is just by, you know, this is just a reapplication of the Evans procedure or the Dretsky displaced perception procedure. You notice that the external auditory event has been happening for a minute, and then conclude you've been hearing it for a minute.
Okay, maybe we can go to the audience for other questions, points, follow-ups. Anything? Yeah.
So one of the ideas that was sort of popping in my head from a couple talks was how accurate it is to talk about the seeming flow of time as something phenomenal, like actually like putting it into the terminology of qualia, for example. And I was thinking about the following distinction. I mean, a lot of the paradigmatic qualia are the kinds of things which we could have cognitive deficits for, colors and shapes and stuff and sounds. It looks like, so one of the questions was, did you think that there was, say, some cognitive deficit you could have, that you could not have the phenomenology of time? Is that even conceptually possible? And then, I don't know, just maybe some comments on what it would mean or what implications it would have.
Anyone?
There's lots of people with, you know, acute psychosis will at least report that, you know, that they don't feel a flow, but I don't know how seriously to take that.
What about the motion blind people?
And then there's the motion blindness, yeah.
Are you asking that sort of generalized motion blindness?
Yeah, no, I mean,
everything's just stopped for some reason.
I guess what I was thinking is because, you know, maybe in part because you can't test it, or you know, if I just said no, I don't feel a flow of time, would you? I'm just not sure how to settle these questions. I guess what I'm worried is that it seems like it's maybe a something about the nature of consciousness generally. It's not very subject specific. That, I mean, maybe it's so general that would tell us that we should think about it differently from all of these other phenomena. Maybe it is being more a cognitive process, or should be tied more into our informational processing rather than phenomenology.
I thought the implication of the passage that Janan had from Proust was that you could be in the state of, as it were, not having a lot of the ordinary temporal phenomenology precisely when you're in the state of being sufficiently disconnected from your memories and anticipations. So the way Proust described himself as being on waking was a very non-temporal kind of state.
There's also, I think, the opposite case for motion blindness. There is some weird condition where the guy doesn't see anything except motion. So that's what they report, at least. What's moving, you ask them, they say nothing. I'm not seeing things. I'm only seeing movement. That would suggest a kind of double dissociation of temporal phenomenology from different kinds of phenomenology. So you can have a standalone phenomenology. If we are to believe these reports, there's a standalone phenomenology of time. Everything else is gone, at least visually, everything else is gone except the motion over time.
Jeanette?
I'm actually attracted by a fairly strong view about this, to say, look, you know, it takes a lot of cognitive preparation to be able to conceive of time. The idea that there's certainly nothing necessary to the idea that our representations of the world have a temporal dimension, and certainly we can construct robots that just represent the simultaneous state of the environment. You know, they have no representation of past states. That's the kind of episodic agent that I had above. So, I mean, I think it actually needs to explain what sort of role the extratemporal dimension in the representational content of our own states has. And I think it's plausible to me, at least, that cognitive temporal phenomenology depends on sort of simultaneous comparisons of representations of multiple temporally ordered psychological states. And if that's right, then I think it's plausible to say that any being that doesn't have that kind of memory wouldn't have temporal phenomenology at all.
Does it have to be simultaneous comparison?
Well, if we just had a succession of states, each of which represented a single kind of time slice of the environment, then I don't see how you would get the space within which temporal phenomena do arise.
Just on this, nobody's really mentioned about the aspect of novelty, that if one is a child or you go on holidays, that, you know, there's so many new things happening that time seems to go a little bit slower than when things are very boring, and as you get older and things are very regular and less novelty, that things get shorter. But I'm reminded of the British children's author, Alan Garner, the one that wrote The Hour Service, because when he was a child, he said that he was very ill and he was in bed for days on end, and his whole he was able to, his whole concept of time is like the days were just flicking past as though, like, minute by minute, and then other times he was able to just, if he was having a good experience, he was able to extend his whole feeling of the event, so that it sort of drew out the time, the psychological time, obviously much more than any of us can do.
Okay, Mike had something. Let's have the finger hand convention. If it's a finger on the, is there a finger on the same point, Greg? Or is yours, Mike, with a hand on it?
It's very possible to wear.
Okay, Mike.
I was just going to say, there's this interesting effect. Lately, computer science people have gotten very into issues about how robots and computers can keep track of time, because what they found is, as they build these more and more complicated programs, and especially obviously with parallel processing, your computer needs to be able to keep track of time. And You run into these asynchronous systems where if the computer can't keep track of its own internal time, so the computer need not be running a program that's in any way about the external time of the world, it's keeping track of its own internal time and cycles. If it can't do that well, the programming just all falls to pieces. So there might be some internal functional reason why cognitive beings as complex as us really need to keep track of their own
internal. Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think it's closely related to a lot of what, I mean, sort of the cognitive function of this extratemporal dimension is closely related to kind of synchronizing what we know about our own internal states with facts about the external world, that has to do with token reflexivity and something. So, yes, I think, yeah, there is an explanation. I meant to raise that as a partly rhetorical question. It needs to be explained, and it ought to be explained by some kind of cognitive function that's served by.
Great.
Yeah, I was going to put in terms of whether on any of the conceptions that have been put forward, whether there could be a, what might be called a flow zombie. In other words, is it possible for there to be two people such that they're functionally and representationally identical? For example, in all the things that Tanan was talking about in her paper, they have the same structure of memories and anticipations and so on. And they're not motion blind in the sense that a person might have, you know, not seeing the bus moving smoothly towards them and everything. They're not any of those things. They're functionally and representationally identical. But one of them has this rich flow phenomenology and the other one doesn't have that at all.
So they're phenomenologically identical in other respects?
Yes.
So the color,
yes,
shape phenomenology is the same, but the flow?
Yes. Yeah.
Like somebody talked about non-supervenient temporal phenomenology. So if there's non-supervenient temporal phenomenology, then I guess that entails that there's...
No. I meant there's a temporal phenomenology that's not supervenient on the sensory phenomenology. So this would be a case where you would have the temporal phenomenology because it's supervenient on the structure of experience, the temporally ordered structures of experience and your memories of those things. So I wouldn't want this.
So you could, if temporal phenomenology is not supervenient on sensory phenomenology, then there's some sense in which you could have the same sensory phenomenology, different temporal phenomenology. But that wouldn't be the kind of case that...
No, because you'd have the same structure of experiences and they'd be temporally ordered in the same way and nested within each other in the same way. So I wouldn't suggest that the temporal phenomenology arises from the kind of pattern of resonance and reverberation among memories of experiences.
I guess I was thinking that Greg's picture is going to have temporal orders among sensory... You have a red experience of red there, and an experience of red there, then experience of red there. We have no temporal phenomena. So the temporal properties of the experiences are the same, but no feeling of temporality.
I guess, but then it wouldn't be the same experience. I mean, you wouldn't have the same succession of experiences because part of the nested structure of experiences replicates within your own psychological state representations of the experiences before then. So you would have a kind of representational difference between these.
Alex?
What do you mean exactly by sensory phenomenology? So what's, I'm just trying to understand what the claim...
Color, auditory experiences, the brain buzzing confusion without any...
But, I mean, if you're just talking about the representation of light, sound, shape, whatever, then, of course, it sounds overwhelmingly plausible that that's not going to determine any temporal phenomenology. I thought you were I thought you were saying something much stronger than that. Oh, right, I see.
Let me ask about this, these flow zombies. Would they experience things as succeeding? So
There'd be a variety of cases, I think. You could say, let's give them all experience of all the B properties, for example. Let them have succession and so forth.
I was thinking this may hang on what Philip was discussing yesterday. If they do experience succession, then it seems more plausible to think that they... I'm inclined to think, I mean, this is just a hunch, but I'm inclined to think that if there's any phenomenology of flow of time, it must supervene on the phenomenology of succession. But, as I said, just a hunch.
Craig, tell me.
It's a completely different topic.
Sure.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, was that Barry? Did you have something else?
Go ahead.
No, just to back up what has been said earlier, really. I think if seed succession is there, then that's a large part of what anyone would probably mean by flow, normal flow. So if you've got that, then you've got the flow, and so the zombies, this particular zombie hypothesis perhaps isn't possible.
Craig?
I was just going to offer an answer to Alex's question about what's the source of the A attraction. Obviously, one answer would be madness, stupidity, confusion, and whatnot. But we can try to be more charitable. And so here's a couple of thoughts. I mean, one is related to the talk where due to the rapidity of the signal speeds, you think you're seeing spatially distant. You think you're seeing spatially distant objects, and so you want to, you don't think you treat the, that sort of slice as special. Another one that I think is even more directly maybe explained to the attraction was the view that Leon, he's not here now, was mentioning to me. I mean, you think of it here, because of your sort of free mobility in space, and you're not sort of freely mobile in time, you can check to see if the hair, you know the hair is not special because you can just move there to come back. I mean, where,
but is that really, I mean, but, if we were sort of rooted to the spot, like, Gerlin's Wilson's weather watchers, would we think there's an objective here?
One thing to say about that, I think it goes back to the analogy with I. If you look, I mean, it's this kind of grammatical illusion that arises when you have simultaneous representation of the view from a number of temporal perspectives, right? It looks like, it does look like, I mean, you get this kind of illusion of the past as moving forever farther away because your perspective, when you've got these sort of perspectives lined up against one another, the perspective itself is shifting as you move up the temporal dimension. Now, in when you compare the view from nowhere of time to have this block universe, there's nothing moving through it. So, I mean, I think that's where you get Weil's picture of the gaze of consciousness tracing.
Right.
The
but how does that distinguish the temporal
gaze?
Okay, so
this is what I want to say. Now, in the case when we look from in the case of time, when we look at the view from nowhere, there's nothing moving through it. So we have to say, there's nothing in the objective temporal order that corresponds to movement. Now, in the case of here, when we shift, when we look at, sort of the shift from different spatial perspectives, when we look in the world for something that's occupying those perspectives, that is to say particular, that's retaining its identity, across shifts in perspective, we find something, namely the body. There is something that retains its identity over time and occupies the different, you know, spatial perspectives. And so we're not sort of left kind of, you know, in the lurch looking around for something to be the occupant of different spatial perspectives. In the case of both I and, you know, now, we are. And I think it's that kind of grammatical illusion that is I suspect that's part of the root of the tendency to think that. And it is just a grammatical illusion. Of course there's no particular that's present at different temporal perspectives and retains its identity over time.
I just want to add something to this, which I think is simply an addition to the suggestions made both by Craig and by Janan. I think a feature of the contrast between the temporal case on the one hand and the spatial and personal cases on the other. Unlike Alex, I think my intuitions are that the personal case is much more like the spatial case, and there's very little temptation to think that it's, as it were, an entirely objective feature of the world that I'm me or whatever, however you try and put it. But the feature I want to note is that it seems very plausible that early in our linguistic development, we find ourselves in the situation of talking to people in different places, and certainly of talking to people, how could it be otherwise, who, as it were, have different personal perspectives. But in the temporal case, in sorts of situations that our ancestors were in, anyway, it's very unusual for us to be in the situation of having a conversation with someone whose temporal perspective is significantly different in this respect. And I don't think that's the only factor, but it's one factor, I think, why the perspectival or lexical character of the temporal case is harder to see for us.
One thing you might say about the temporal case, many people at least think even if the A theory is false, it's coherent. Right, I guess there are some objections that say it's incoherent, but many people think it's coherent, but just empirically false. Maybe there could have been a world, or we can conceive of there being such a thing as passage. We seem to have some kind of conceptual grip on passage, whether or not it's instantiated in the world, or we don't even seem to have a conceptual grip on spatial, the relevant kind of spatial passage, or even a spatial objective here. What would a world with an objective here be like? What would a world with an objective I be like? But it seems that the world with an objective present, many people at least think they can conceive of that. Now, if that's at least a coherent concept, a coherent content, then it at least becomes a plausible hypothesis that this content is represented in the phenomenology of temporal experience, that we represent the world as being that way, and therefore that's the source of the intuition that this is the way the world is, and if indeed that was coherent in the spatial, and the analogous thing wasn't coherent in the spatial case, then that would explain why there wasn't such a tug in the spatial case.
Wouldn't the spatial analogy be not, would be that space moves? I mean, the idea that time flows, the spatial analogy would be that space moves, and I think that's plausibly incoherent. I mean, you need another dimension in which space moves, in the same way that to get the idea of time flowing, you need to implicitly embed time in another dimension.
So that's an argument that the A theory is actually incoherent?
I think it is, yeah.
Okay.
And just a footnote to what you said. I think I find the idea of a world that just has you in it incoherent. But speaking for myself, it's just the solipsist world.
Yeah.
And I understand what that world.
Well, the presentist world isn't just a. I mean, the world of the objective now isn't sort of a world of just this time and all that stuff has zero status. It has this sort of status in which, well, it doesn't have the same objective status, but it was and it will be. And so, what you would need is something analogous to that. The solipsist world is easy.
Versions of solipsism in which we have something like that. All of you are just zombies.
Okay. Jonathan.
I think in thinking of what it would be like to have a privileged here, we should distinguish between different ideas of what the flow of time would be. So if you have a sort of if you have a presentist idea where all that's real is the now, then a moving here would require some sort of higher dimension to move in, but there's this other view where you have sort of eternalism plus a moving spotlight of the now. And you could do that with space. So imagine that as we're passing sort of left to right along the room, there's this sort of red glow that just moves. That would give us some reason to think that there was some sort of metaphysically privileged spatial location that was moving as things went. Or imagine that for a metaphysically privileged eye, imagine that people had halos, and the special halo sort of moved around the room as each person spoke, you know, sort of like instead of a microphone, you got a halo, and that would be sort of the metaphysically privileged eye. So I mean, you can sort of, I mean, these are sort of joke pictures, but it, I think it's coherent to.
Yeah, but that's also, you're bringing in time in that dimension, right? It's not a sort of pure privileged eye; it's an eye which moves about in time. And you know, so Janan's moving space, you can see space moving around in time. I guess some aethers, I think you don't need to bring in space, you don't need to bring in the self, it's time itself is intrinsically, you know, passing in a way which I think wouldn't have analogs. Now maybe they're wrong, but I think that's the view.
Just a footnote. Sorry.
Go on.
I mean, I put in time because I had the thing moving. But if you don't want to put in time, just freeze the halo or freeze the glowing red line. And that's the objective here at the, you know, not moving around.
Yeah, just two footnotes on that. First of all, it's hard, just offhand, it's very hard to see how the A theory about time could be coherent, but the corresponding A theory about space couldn't be. I mean, just offhand. I mean, maybe, I'm sure you're right, it's sort of somehow easier to wrap our minds around a privilege now than it is for us to wrap our minds around a privilege here, but that just seems to amount to saying that, well, it's just much more, you know, gripping, the idea of
I think the claim would be that we have a concept of passing time, and we just don't have a concept of passing space, and that's why it's coherent, is because we have a concept.
Yeah. Well, and then the other thing was, of course, all these explanations, you were sort of explicit about this, all these explanations do suppose that there really isn't some intuitive puzzle in the case of I, and well, at any rate, just an autobiographical remark. When I first read the View from Nowhere, I was sort of totally gripped with the idea that, you know, one could sort of survey the entire universe and in personal terms, and it would seem definitely some further fact which of these people I am.
I was just staring in the mirror, and damn, it's always that same guy staring back. Can't blame him. Steve. Finger? Yeah. Is that a finger on this?
Oh, hand.
Well, we're running out of time. Hugh, did you have a hand that you wanted to...
No, my hand morphed into a finger.
Maybe Sally, very quickly.
Okay, well, my question is just probably a bit spurious, but I was wondering what the speakers thought, those who addressed it, of that sort of classic thought experiment where you can separate the experience of time from the flow of time where time freezes. So during which, if we can say that, nothing happens, no clocks tick, absolutely nothing happens, and then it starts
during
again.
What?
And we're never going to notice that, so we can't experience that freezing time, but the thought is that objectively time is supposed to have stopped. I don't know how that sits with any of your views. I just thought it was kind of fun to see what you thought.
It's assuming the case, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
This shoemaker type case, the book freezes and adding it to a big global freeze. I was like, that thought that make quite a compelling case of that as a logical possibility.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it sits well with Craig's idea of the kind of subjectivity.
I guess I've always thought the shoemaker maybe made logically conceivable, although I think, you know, if you go anywhere, move anywhere away from logical conceivability into or toward, no more logically possible, it's even just a slight step that way, you know. I'm not even sure. I think it's coherent. I mean, these different regions don't interact. It's really, once you start thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Really, how do you know the frozen unless you can interact with it?
Yeah.
Well,
you can
be
sure
that
there's no this gap.
I'm not quite sure what the example, the idea that if everything stops, then there's no time.
Well, that's the question.
That's the question. I mean, that's an interesting.
It's an intuition.
Just going in, you know, Craig's direction a little bit. I think that if you think about that from a, you know, an early relativity standpoint, Galilean relativity. I mean, what counts as stopped? For who? So, you know, whether an object, if there's one object in the universe, so for one frame of reference, it's it's motionless. Another frame of reference is moving at constant velocity and might constitute a good clock. So I don't really know what to say to that, but I think that's an interesting aspect of it, because it's going to be tied in, what you would say might be tied in with your views about the reality of absolute space.
Yeah. Greg, do you have something very quickly?
Just a quick one on the here. Suppose you had an it's a little bit analogous to the those who think, well, maybe if we had another temporal dimension, we could do the flow on that. So if you had another spatial dimension, that further spatial dimension could privilege different parts of our existing three-dimensional space. So it wouldn't be done, you wouldn't be bringing in time to do it, but you would be bringing in another spatial dimension.
Okay.
I just wanted to disavow the charge of inflationism.
Okay, thanks to everybody.